This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Including Purity Ring, A-Track, RJD2, and Tyco, as well as on-site art installations, a hookah lounge, and splash pool. That's July 26th through 28th, 2013 at Wolf Run Ranch in Oregon. Tickets on sale now at whatthefestival.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken toll, we ducked inside the doorways, thunder went crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sounds, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Through the city's melted furnace, unexpectedly we watched, with faces hidden as the walls were tightening. As the echo of the wedding bells before the blowing rain.
And hello, welcome to another edition of Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, commemorating KBOO's 45th anniversary. This evening's program harks back to KBOO's origins as a kind of stepchild or sister station of KRAB, or CRAB, radio in Seattle, in its first years on the air. You'll hear an interview with Gray Hartig and Robert Pooh Rogers, mainstays of KBOO engineering for many years, done 20 years ago by News and Public Affairs Director Kathleen Stevenson. The interview was originally for a 25th anniversary special, but only a portion of it was aired at that time, so much of what you'll hear has never made it to the airwaves. Hartig and Rogers trade anecdotes about the personalities involved in the station's early days, the freewheeling and unstructured atmosphere at the time, and the many changes of venue KBOO went through before finally settling down at its current location here at 20 Southeast 8th. As station engineers at a very low-budget operation, they were faced with constant technical challenges and the need to continually improvise, which they look back on with a great sense of fondness and humor. They wax wistful about the free-spiritedness and sense of possibility of those times at KBOO and offer a unique perspective on changes at the station over the years. They also don't hold back from some fairly strong criticisms of a KBOO culture and programming that they feel are very different from those early days. Whether you agree with what they say or not, it seems somehow appropriate to share their perspective at a time when vigorous debate is going on at and around the station over how to keep the station vital and relevant in a very different and difficult times. But mostly it's just great KBOO history. This is from our radio archives, a 20-year-old interview with Robert Pooh Rogers and Gray Hartig.
Could each of you say your name and the involvement you've had at KABU, the basic summary of what you've done over the years here?
My name is Robert Pooh Rogers. I have been a staff engineer here at one time. I've built this place at least once, helped build it any number of times, and climbed lots of towers and moved antennas around.
I'm Gray Hartig. I was the chief engineer here starting in December 1968, about 6 months after it went on the air. I got involved in September of 68 and have been involved some way in the engineering of this place ever since.
So, Gray, tell me about what you mean when you got involved. How did you get involved? What happened there?
Well, when I was but a baby boy in Seattle, I hung out a lot at Crab, who was the mother station of KABU. KABU was originally licensed to Crab in Seattle, the Jack Straw Memorial Foundation. And I got hauled one night over to a funny little house down over the hill on Alki Point, which belonged to Jim Hatfield. And I got hauled over by Ben Dawson. I met a fellow named David Calhoun, who was supposed to be starting this new radio station in Portland we'd been hearing about. That was kind of my first introduction. And then when I told Benjamin, who was the chief engineer at Crab, that I was moving to Portland to go to college, he said, "Oh, good. Go make sure you've got your license. You're the new chief engineer at KABU." So I came to town with a job.
So how did that work? So then you came into town, and what happened? How did you connect with the actual place?
Well, Calhoun picked me up at the train station in his little beat-up Volkswagen and hauled me off, and we looked at the radio station, and then we decided to go look at the transmitter, which was up in Harold Singleton's garage on Healy Heights. And you have to understand that this was late at night. It was like midnight. And before we could go look at the transmitter, we had to go out to this church in Beaverton, where Calhoun liked to practice the organ. Calhoun was also an organist. He had this deal with the church that he would go out late on Saturday nights and practice to discourage the people from coming in and screwing on the pews, you see, because the matrons got upset when they found they used condoms on Sunday morning, though. I mean, this was before the age of safe sex, so I guess they had no sense of humor, but at any rate, we had to go out and practice the organ for a couple of hours, and we did that. And then he drove me up to the transmitter from Beaverton at 2 in the morning. And it took me about 3 months to find the transmitter again. I had no idea where I was. I was fresh in town, and there's no place harder to get to than Healy Heights.
And that is a perfect, absolutely perfect description of KABU at that time. It was the incredibly bizarre and eccentric and brilliant David Calhoun and his life and KABU all sort of falling downhill together in a big pastiche of events.
Yeah, I mean, when KABU got its first studios, which were down the corner of 3rd and Salmon in a little 8x12 office, this was a major event in Calhoun's life because it meant he could move off of Michael and Mary Wells' back porch and into the studio. So it was an 8x12 studio with a little itty-bitty board in the corner and a couple of enormous turntables that looked like washing machines. And Calhoun's ancient consumer-grade Ampex tape recorder that was permanently out of the case because it had to be fixed all the time and it was too hard to get it in and out of the case. That all lived in one end, and Calhoun's sleeping bag kind of rolled out in the middle, and then his harpsichord in the other end. And that was KABU. And he would go over every day to Multnomah County Library and get interesting records to play, and he would play them, and occasionally other people would come in and help, but not very often.
And the broadcast day was?
It was whatever what Calhoun had to do that day, basically. He did some stuff in the morning, usually, and then somewhere around midday would either sign off or go to repeat Crab and do repeats till the evening sometime, and then he would come back.
My memory was that the broadcast day was usually something like 6 a.m. till 9 or maybe 11 if it was late that day, and then off all the middle of the day.
Well, yeah, it changed in there at some point because Crab's broadcast day was from 5 in the morning until 11, and then sign off between 11 and 5 in the afternoon and sign back on because they didn't have a production room, and they did all their production in the main studio during midday. Plus, they really believed in the philosophy that if there wasn't anything good to put on the radio, you shouldn't put anything on the radio at all.
So
during the time that Crabb was maintaining those hours, KBOO kind of did the same thing. And as Crabb built an additional studio and was on all day, then KBOO could had the opportunity or the option of repeating Crabb during part of the day. And it was this repeater was well, it was less than wonderful. It was a Scott receiver located in this doctor's house up in the West Hills with an enormous antenna strapped to his chimney. And they were picking up an off-the-air signal from Seattle from a 20-kilowatt station whose antenna, if it was any lower, would have had to dug a hole in the ground to put it up. It got some good signal most of the time.
Well, tell them about the Spudnut stand.
Well, yeah, the station, Crabb, was in a converted Spudnut stand, which was, all of 12 by 20, maybe? Or
that was little. It was maybe 15 by 20.
15 by
What's
20.
What's a Spudnut?
Spudnuts, well, that was a particular brand of donuts made with potato flour that were very popular in the Northwest. I don't know if they got out of the Northwest or not.
And there was a wooden fence around the lot.
Wooden fence around the lot. The transmitter hung up the back of the building. Its face of the transmitter was flush with the wall of the building. And then the rest of it hung out, and it was kind of a shed roof over it.
And there was a little, like you'd chainsawed a hole in a building and put a refrigerator outside the building so you could open the door of the refrigerator from inside the building.
Yeah, that's basically it. And the whole thing was sagging, and the floor bounced up and down.
There was one microphone hung from the center of the
right
ceiling in the
for the main studio
in the room that you walked into when you came in off the street.
Right, and the control room had this board that Jeremy had nailed together out of literally boards and put kitchen linoleum on. And he had constructed this board with wires everywhere. I mean, it was completely undocumented and was, you had no idea what was going on. And there was one day I remember when Dave Wirtz, who ran the Bluegrass show, got a little excited and knocked over his half gallon of sweet wine that always lived on top of the board when he's done his show, and went glug 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 through the board. And we were off the air for 2 days while I pulled the board apart and washed it. But at any rate,
the early history of KBOO and of Crabb are totally enmeshed.
Yeah, they're entwined. But coming back to Portland, we were trying to pick up this weird station in Seattle down here, and the commission said that we were not allowed to use Crabb as the main studio for Portland. So Portland technically had to have a main studio for KBOO, well, which meant we had to be able to do station identifications locally. Well, Jeremy's solution to this was to buy a Mighty Mutz car stereo 8-track player and gut it and to hook it up to the receiver such in a way that you could push a button in Seattle and it would trigger the Mighty Mutz to give an ID, right? Well, it was also set up that whenever the signal faded, it would start doing continuous IDs. So sometimes KBOO consisted of continuous IDs for hours at a time when there was no signal available.
That's actually, someone told me a story of first tuning into KBOO, and that's what they heard. It was this continuous ID.
Right.
So describe Dave Calhoun.
Well, once upon a time, some KBOO people and myself were traveling in a car, and I realized that we were all characters from The Wizard of Oz, and the character that Calhoun was playing was the lion. At that time, he was 6'4" and had red hair. And
lots of it.
And really gruff and growly and irritable.
Big bushy beard.
And a very independent kind of guy, not exactly used to dealing well with groups of people.
Or even individually with people.
The engineering grandfather of all of the community radio stations, Benjamin Dawson, who brought Gray in, was also responsible for introducing Calhoun to all of this stuff, described Calhoun as an apprentice saint.
Why is that?
Well, he used to go to Louisville and hang out with the Trappist monks there.
And he really is, I mean, for all of his difficulty in associating with people, he does a number of good and saintly acts in his life. I mean, most recently that I know of, when Ern Hood, who was one of the founding fathers of KBOO, died. Give a little history here. Ern Hood was a musician and creative weirdo in Portland for many years who had been stricken with polio as a young man. And KABU's application was signed, application for KABU's license was signed in Ern Hood's living room. At any rate, later in his life, Ern was stricken with post-polio syndrome, which is, you know, a recurrence of polio symptoms that happens late in life. And at some point, he became respirator-bound and decided he did not want to live his life that way. And one of the people he called to help him unplug was Calhoun, to come down and talk with him about it and to help him do the act.
And that kind of thing happens typically in Calhoun's life.
Yeah.
Things that the rest of us hear about once in our lifetime is a biannual event for Calhoun.
When you say he would go get interesting records from the library, do you have any examples of what interesting meant in those days?
Well, for Calhoun, it tended towards classical music, specifically Baroque and Renaissance and medieval music, especially the early music, because in those days, nobody was playing that kind of music.
And we aren't anymore.
And it also, as a tradition from Crabb, involved a lot of what gets called ethnic music, music from other cultures. And the Multnomah County Library didn't have an extensive collection, but it was gone through almost entirely. Then whatever other resources he could come up with to get recordings of this stuff. Plus, there was, at that point, the informal bicycle network, which was a group of like-minded stations that decided to share programming amongst themselves, and they did this by exchanging tapes and called the bicycle network because the tapes got bicycled around the network, as it were. You know, when you got done with your stack of tapes, you sat on them for at least a year and a half and then mailed them to the next station.
It was a slow exchange.
Right, but, you know, who cares about timeliness?
A lot of early KABU went back down the drain because if something was archived and somebody else didn't know what it was, the tape would get grabbed and bulked and reused for...
Well, Pooh, how did you come into the picture?
I was interested in radio in high school. I'd gone to Benson, and my chums were all radio nuts. And so we were building a pirate AM radio station in my basement in the summer of 1968 in northeast Portland. And I'd heard about this radio station that was starting up in Portland. And the next thing I know, I had started Portland State, and somehow or other I fell in with Calhoun. And we would take these incredible midnight rides in his beat-up Volkswagen to various churches to play the organ. Ultimately, it was a year or two before I met Gray, which was the summer of 70?
69, I think. We met in 69 sometime. But anyway, I needed somebody as chief engineer of KABU who would do all the awful things that I didn't want to do or was too scared to do. That was Robert. He'd do it. He'd do anything. Let Mikey try it.
I kind of cut my teeth on climbing up Harold Singleton's 50-foot self-supporting tower in a sleet storm and trying to make our cobbled-together antenna system work under the direction of Benjamin Dawson.
Yeah.
And Gray and Calhoun.
So how much climbing did you do?
A lot.
Still is.
Yeah. In this half of my life, my livelihood is a product of all of my rigorous early training with KABU and climbing towers and cobbling things together.
Did you have any dangerous experiences, any close calls?
Not really. I was always terrified. I never liked it. I took the antenna system off of Crabb. We didn't, you know, the rest of the story about Crabb is that the little donut stand on the side of the hill where the studio was located that really started community radio in the United States had a wooden utility pole in the backyard, and their antenna was mounted on the side of that. And one of my early assignments was when they dismantled that facility to take the antenna system off of that pole. And I was completely scared.
All right, this pole was all of 35 feet tall or something.
It was 45.
Maybe 45. This pole literally was against the back wall of the studio. So the antenna was right above the studio, which meant in this day when we're worried about radio frequency radiation from things, this place was hot. I mean, the standard tuning procedure for the transmitter.
I remember.
You know, transmitter was this wonderful clunker from 1948 at Collins with meters everywhere, you know. And then lots of dials and knobs. You could twist things all over the place and meters would do anything. But the way you really tuned it was we had this 7.5-watt Christmas tree light. And it had two wires soldered onto it. Just wires, one going to one side and one going to the other. And it was pinned to the ceiling of the studio. And you tuned the transmitter till the light bulb got brightest.
I remember that now. This was the best radio engineering you could ever hope to do. When things had tubes in them, when there weren't that many transistors in the world.
Right. You'd tune things by sight. You know, when the tubes got real red, you were off.
KBOO's created several very good engineers. I remember I learned the word penury from Calhoun because it was a description of KBOO. People got good at cobbling things and making do.
Yeah. I mean, there wasn't any money. Calhoun's salary was $50 a month. The station's operating budget was $50 a month above his salary. I technically got $50 a month as chief engineer, but I never took it. My salary was 2 Sleazeburgers a week. That was what I demanded. Be hauled down to the local hamburger joint, be given 2 Sleazeburgers a week. And that was it. That was, you know, what the station ran on.
Gray was a religion major at Reed and drove a Honda 90.
Tried mighty to kill small him. Horse for a cowboy your size, as a friend's daddy once said.
Gray's kind of large, for those who have never laid eyes on the boy.
Tell me about the early taping of everything.
Well, KBOO in its early days got a real significant portion of its programming by taping everything in the community. I mean, sort of the informal motto was, if it makes noise, tape it. And if you're a volunteer at KBOO, KBOO, when it signed on the air, didn't have programs. People didn't come in to do their little shtick on the radio, you know, because the philosophy was that the radio station owned the hours and then they would bring in people to do things. And one of the things to get the community back out to the community was to go tape stuff. And so you could go to any event in town that was happening. Lectures, you know, political rallies, virtually every concert that wasn't being handled, covered by the straight media, that you could get into, and there was tape, KBOO, with a tape recorder in the front and a microphone with this lovely little banner, triangular banner that Sue Police sewed for us, that was very straight on one side, was very kinky looking on the other side, and that was hanging from the microphone, depending on the appropriate venue you were in, you know. And that's what it was. I mean, I don't know how many hours a week we did. I bet there was 20 hours a week of stuff that's just been recorded. And it was always done just as it happened sorts of things. People didn't come in and then edit it and try to turn it into something. The event was recorded. You may lop off some applause and some things like that and block it a little bit or cut out some questions if you couldn't hear them from the audience, that kind of thing. But other than that, it was just presented to the audience as it had happened to the live audience. That was what happened to KBOO. And that's what happened when you were a volunteer. The first thing that happened when you walked through the door was you were shown how to use a tape recorder and you were put on the recording list. And when you got called up, you went out and recorded things.
The Ampex 600.
The Ampex 600.
Size of a small suitcase.
Mm-hmm.
And twice as heavy. And three times as old.
Three times as old.
That was our tape recorder.
Right. You have to understand, this is before the cassette was invented. The cassette was not yet on the market. We were still trying to fight 8-track tape recorders in those days, or 8-track car stereos in those days. You know, there really were no portable tape machines other than portable reel-to-reel machines.
Calhoun used to do remote broadcasts by using phone lines. And he would just get a dial line and, you know, call the studio a couple of times until he got a clean line. And then he'd hook the Ampex up to it and squirt the signal down the telephone line, using the little plug-in transformer that runs the lights on your Princess telephone as an audio transformer. And years later, I found one of those hung on the phone line in the basement of the Koinonia House by Portland State from one of Calhoun's early remote broadcasts.
Right. Everybody, I ragged him for years. Using a power transformer to do that? This is weird, Calhoun. And I actually, many years later, took one of those things and measured it, find out how it would work as a transformer. And turns out they make really quite dandy transformers.
One of the people in my basement when I was in high school, when we were building the Pirate AM radio station, has gone on to his glory in broadcasting, and that is Lee Alexander Wood, who is presently the chief engineer of Channel 6 TV.
And probably will deny everything.
Which brings up Radio Free Portland, Gray.
Yeah. When was this? Was it spring of 69, wasn't it? Late spring. It was when the big Cambodia incursion happened as part of the Vietnam War. Nixon sent the troops into Cambodia, and there was a student strike at Portland State. And I got involved, you know, being an outside agitator of some sort, and decided that the thing to do is they needed a radio station to, you know, keep the morale of the troops up. And we... we created a radio station. At first, it was in one of the dorms at PSU, but that got a little spooky because there was lots of federal agents around and things like that. So we decided to go guerrilla and put it in the back of Bill. What's Bill's last name? Mictum?
No, it wasn't.
Not Bill Mictum.
Tall, skinny guy.
Yeah, yeah.
A blue step van.
Yeah, I had a blue step van. I forget his name now. It lived in the back of the blue step van. And I had been made by the FBI or somebody at some point, so I had to kind of stay away from this. And I'd cruise around town finding likely transmitting spots, antenna spots, you know, and then I would communicate from payphones to the van, telling them where they should go hook up their next broadcast. They would do like a broadcast every 2 hours for 20 minutes or something. We chose a variety of things, including the St. John's Bridge for antennas, St. John's Bridge and the Southern Pacific Railroad tracks, and KXL's FM tower up on Healy Heights, which turned out to be one of the better ones.
200 feet from Harold Singleton's garage.
Right, which is how I knew about it. Right?
Which is where KBOO's transmitter was located.
And then I had various long wire antennas stretched around the town in people's backyards. I had fun with the tail. I was being tailed for a while by, I assume, the FBI. This guy would park out in front of my house, or actually up the block from my house, and I'd get up in the morning and come out, and I'd spot him. And I would pull away from the curb, and then I would drive around the block and park in front of my house again. And by the time he rounded the corner, coming around the block following me, he realized I'd stopped, he'd have to go by, you know. He couldn't kind of just stop up the block. That was too obvious. You get to wave at him. And one day I was over visiting my friends Tony and Annie, and it was real hot. This was like May. And you know how we get these hot days in May. And the FBI agent was out in the car at the end of the driveway, just sweating away, you know. And I was inside talking with Tony and Annie, having a good time drinking lemonade, you know. And I finally decided, you know, this poor bastard out there really needs some relief. So I poured a nice big tall glass of lemonade, went out to give it to him, you know. And he starts looking real nervous as I'm approaching his car. And I get about 20 feet away, and he pulled away. He wouldn't cop to the fact that he needed some lemonade, I guess.
But not all of the grown-ups affiliated with Portland's pirate radio station, Radio Free Portland, had such a uptight attitude about it. Francis McCann,
right,
the district inspector for the FCC, I interviewed him a year later, and he described Radio Free Portland as the most creative thing that had happened to Portland radio in 40 years.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. When we went mobile, there was this question about whether we were causing any interference to anybody, and we just wanted to be Radio Free Portland. We weren't trying to hurt anybody else, so I'd give Francis a call every morning and say, "Hey, Francis." I mean, he figured out it was me because he'd heard a rumor that was this Reed student involved with this radio station. He said, "Oh, that's great." So I called him up and said, "Hey, Francis, how we doing?" And he'd say, "Well, you signed on at about 840 kilohertz, and by 7 p.m. you drifted up to 860. And you could be frequency reports every morning and let me know if they had any complaints."
And this was an AM radio station.
Right, 300 watts.
And when I was in high school, when we were doing all of these things, I'd say the majority of high school kids then didn't know what FM was.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, they listened to KISN, KISN, on AM radio. That was the big bubblegum station in town.
Mm-hmm. And I had an ancient Hazeltine Fremdyne FM receiver in my basement with the cabinet off of it, and we were always tweaking with it. And I'd turn it to FM, and my friends would go, "What's that? I never heard anything. What is that?" And I'd say, "That's FM." And "What kind of radio is that?" So yeah. It was an interesting time.
Yeah. I mean, when KBOO signed on, I don't think there were any 100-kilowatt stations in town at the time. I think the most powerful was 20. They're now 100 kilowatts is now the legal maximum for this area.
100,000 watts.
Yeah, 100,000 watts.
And if you're a radio station, you have to be there.
When KBOO signed on, it was 10 watts out of the transmitter. You know, this is about the same power as your average Christmas tree bulb. And with the antenna, you could get a little more power. It was 40 watts. But we covered the Portland market spottily, but we covered it with 40 watts. We had subscribers as far away as Washougal. You know, but we had to instruct people on how to tune their FM radio to find us, and, you know. But it was interesting, is people would really go and make the effort to try to find KBOO. You know, there was this dedicated listening audience. Part of it was the classical music freaks. They'd had their only classical music station close up on them.
Thank you, Ron Tonkin.
Thank you, Ron Tonkin.
Well, he started KBOO.
Huh.
He bought KPFM, which was the classical music station in Portland, and rocked it.
Yeah.
And as soon as that happened, people wanted classical music.
Right.
And who were those people?
Portland Listener Supported Radio.
Yeah, PLSR, Listener Supported Radio, was a group that formed down here, and Earn Hood was involved with it, and I'm not sure who else was.
Well, the story I heard was that they approached Pacifica and asked for help. Yeah. Pacifica turned them down cold. And then he went to Seattle and asked Lorenzo, and he, because he's a typewriter addict, pounded out an application for them and turned around and said, here's your well, wait, come back. Your application is done now. And so he ended up filing it because there wasn't anybody in Portland to do it. They just evaporated as soon as somebody started doing something, which was Lorenzo.
Yeah.
And his early program guides, whoever has them, please return them.
Why?
I got the Pooh House, my household, always got, Calhoun always mailed me a program guide. And I never gave Cabo a dime. But he liked me. And so all of the first 3 or 4 years of the Cabo program guide, plus a lot of the program guides from Seattle, I don't know how I ended up with those, were in a box. I've never told this to anybody. When we moved into the studio downtown on Yamhill, I stuck this box up in the record library for safekeeping, and it immediately disappeared. And I assume some busybody at KABU decided they were archive materials and they should be saved. Well, that's why I'd put them there, and they're still mine. I never gave them away, and I wish someone would bring them back.
What were they like?
It was mimeographed on both sides and folded down the middle, and sometimes
an 8.5 by 11 sheet folded.
Sometimes 2 pages and stapled, and an address label slapped on the front.
For the early days of KABU, people got the Crab program guide with maybe a blow-in from KABU for some things that were happening locally. But you got Crab program guide. And those were a little larger. Those ran to 8 pages or 10 pages.
Usually with an incredible essay from Lorenzo on God knows what.
Right. Lorenzo is basically a writer. And in fact, he went on, after he got out of the radio biz, to form a literary review called the Fessenden Review, which was, unfortunately, went belly up about 3 years ago, but a very striking magazine. And you would get these wonderful philosophical dissertations on much of anything, some of it to do with radio, a lot of it not. And in it, you got a lot of the idea. Pretty soon you understood the philosophy of what started this kind of radio by understanding what interested Lorenzo and what he thought radio ought to be. And while he didn't set out to teach you that, that's what you ended up learning.
Has that become your philosophy?
Well, it's very similar. I mean, I fought with Lorenzo at times when I worked with him, but because there were times I thought he was too narrow, but mostly it is. Yeah, I want radio to be very challenging. I mean, I consider I got my education being the Monday night announcer at Crab for 2 years when I was in high school. I learned a lot more there than I ever did in high school or college. I don't find that it gives me that anymore, unfortunately. I mean, I want to be exposed to things that make my mind work, things I've never heard before, things that I didn't know could exist, new ways of looking at things. And I want to see the variety and the sort of width of human endeavor, which is so possible in radio. I mean, radio is a really wonderful medium. You know, television is nothing as a medium compared to radio. It doesn't engage the person at all.
And you're listening to KBOO Community Radio here in Portland. And my name's Paul Rowland, and this is a special 45th anniversary program called Tune In, Turn On, and Remember. And you're listening a interview with Gray Hartig and Robert Pooh Rogers, longtime KABU engineers who were around from the early days of the station, being interviewed by Kathleen Stevenson 20 years ago for, at that time, a 25th anniversary special. And only a small portion of this had been interviewed at that time, so this is stuff that hasn't been on the airwaves before. So we'll continue with that until 7 o'clock when Hard Knock Radio comes on.
Could each of you say your name and the involvement you've had at KABU, the basic summary of what you've done over the years here?
My name is Robert Pooh Rogers. I have been a staff engineer here at one time. I've built this place
Rebel,
at least once. Helped build it any number of
for
times.
The rake, tolling for the luckless, they abandoned and forsake, tolling for the outcast, burning constantly at stake. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing through the mad, mystic hammering of the wild, ripping hail. The sky cracked its palms in naked wonder as the clinging of the church bells blew far into the breeze, leaving only bells of lightning and its thunder. Striking for the gentle, striking for the kind.
And the reason they started up is because David Sarnoff tried to kill FM broadcasting because he owned the AM networks. And he told the commission to kill FM. And the original FM band was not 88 to 108 like it is now, but it was
around 40, high 40 megahertz, low 50s.
And he said, kill it. And the commission dutifully did.
Right, because he wanted those frequencies for television, which he was pushing.
So sort of explain that for the layperson, what that means. Those were just frequencies that now aren't on the band?
Well, it was the original FM band was like 46 to 50 megahertz, and David Sarnoff told the FCC, the head of the Radio Corporation of America, told the FCC to move it. And they took the FM radio band, which was just starting to function,
right,
and moved it to where it is now, at 88 megahertz, 208.
Which effectively destroyed all the stations that were then on the air.
Because the radios didn't tune anything any longer.
Again, he wanted that frequency band in the high 40s and 50s for part of his upcoming television. Now that he controlled all of AM radio, he saw television as the future of making money in electronic media.
And he was certainly right about that. But as a sop to honesty, when the commission did his order, executed his order, they reserved the bottom 20 channels on the new FM band for non-commercial educational use, which I'm certain they thought would be straitjacket institutions like major universities having broadcasting departments to teach people to speak upon the electric radio. And then these funny communists started using them for non-commercial alternative broadcasting.
Which irritated them no end, I'm sure.
But it was written into the law, and there was nothing they could do about it.
Right.
And that is what created this stuff, this funny radio. And in that time, everything was incredibly rigid and straight. There were huge battles fought about obscenity, and Crabb kept getting busted. And
two or three times.
There was like landmark law made about freedom of speech and freedom of the press through basically Crabb standing alone. And it wasn't even one of us. It was on a commercial frequency.
Yeah.
Which is why they're not there any longer, because they were sold in an ill-founded move to move down to an educational station. But KABU was the first of independent, non-affiliated FM station on an educational frequency.
Well, some of the Pacifica stations were there. I mean, KPFA is on an educational frequency.
But they were always operated, they were not independent, they were operated by this monolithic political organization.
It's true.
So we're the first baby, because we didn't have Pacifica running us, we didn't have Lorenzo running us like Seattle. KPFA was kind of on its own. And what Gray is talking about an opportunity to broadcast, Calhoun knew that. You know, the total KPFA broadcast day was in two chunks, in the morning and then in the late afternoon and evening time, and sometimes into the night. And it was maybe a 10-hour broadcast day. And Calhoun would turn I remember him turning the transmitter on and just not doing anything. And the thing about FM was it was quiet, because the full power of the signal went out all the time, and that gave you that silence. When you tune across the FM band in the old days with crappy radios, before they had built-in muting circuits, you heard all the static, and then you'd hit a carrier, and it would be dead silent. And Calhoun would describe KABU as being a hole that you put things through. And if you didn't have anything to say, don't say it. And he would just be silent. There was no compulsion. And then when you did have something to say, it was like the things Gray was talking about, things that would challenge you and intrigue you and truly educate you. And KABU is largely now a specialist in narrowcasting, where we complain about them.
It's preaching to the converted, you know. And, I mean, there's reasons for this to happen. This kind of radio was not started by hippies. This kind of radio was started by beatniks who got all the hippies to do the work for them. I mean, it was transitional period. You look at Crab, it's signed on in 1962. And the people who were the driving forces behind him were educated in the 50s. And one of the hallmarks of the beat generation as an alternative to the established society was that it was very intellectual. And it was very much into things of the mind. Well, one of the hallmarks of the hip generation was a really intense anti-intellectualism that said that what was important were things only of the heart and of feeling and of pleasure and of things like that. And there was this real edge to it all the time. It was very anti-intellectual. Well, those people run this kind of radio now. That's one aspect. I mean, that's where they grew up. Another is that this kind of radio, instead of being run by the people who are kind of cutting out now, the edge, people who are trying something new, is run by the establishment. I mean, it's run by middle-aged old farts like us that
hate nuclear power.
Hate nuclear power and do this and do that. You know, they've established what their belief structure is, and they'll be damned if they'll have it challenged on their own radio station.
Although I'm not trying to cut you off because you're critical, but I want to concentrate on history stuff.
Well, we've waited 25 years to say this.
Damn it,
we've been patient for so long. And this is the history of KBOO.
Yeah. Where it comes from and why it is what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one can like what it is now or not like what it is now. That one's free to make those decisions. But the reasons it got to where it is are important.
We used to, open forum. Anyone could come in and talk about anything.
All right.
KBOO did not censor or have a political point of view at all. You know, it was to say what you had to say. Truly, it was empowering. And it was no holds barred. And presently, I don't think that's true. I think there's too much political correctness and polarization.
And there's not holes to do it in. I mean, KBOO is no longer a hole to put things through because the hole is cheek by jowl programmed up. You know, there's no cracks to put anything through.
Sort of like the, you know, when KBOO popped up on the air, it was a crack. It was an artifact of Sarnoff trying to kill the competition. And this funny little artifact of 20 channels being reserved for educational use. And anyone who could figure out how to incorporate a nonprofit educational foundation in their state could be a broadcaster, could get one of these licenses.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there are no more channels available. I mean, we've now technically run up against the wall, at least under the current technology. Mm-hmm. There are no more channels in the Portland area.
There's a couple things that maybe I could ask you about that before we go to those other issues. One of them was that transition period then when KBOO became independent. If you guys have anything to say about that time.
Well, I remember David Calhoun writing the bylaws for the KBOO Foundation. Went on Whitaker Street, an early, early KBOO house, off of Southwest Front. David Calhoun, station manager, was camped out in his army mummy bag under the back porch of that house. That's where he lived. David Roland was living in the house. David B. Olmsted was staying there, and another David was visiting, occupying the house. And this is why Calhoun was magical and why he was an apprentice saint, and his connectedness with the universe, this bizarre connection that always followed Calhoun around. And ding dong, someone's at the door. Calhoun walks up to the door with his 6'4" gruff, billowing red hair and red beard, scraggly, intimidating appearance, and just wrenches the door open and says, "Don't tell me, your name's David, isn't it?" And it was. It floored the guy. It terrified him. He was a door-to-door salesman or Jehovah's Witness or something. Yeah, how did you know? So David Roland wrote the bylaws, and he had seen that Crab had lots of problems because of lifetime board members. Lorenzo's board had been appointed for life. And so he made sure that the KBOO board was elected. And it was just, you know, they never really wanted to hold our license. There was always this push to, would you please get together and take it? We want to give this to you. And I think we owed them some money. There was like, we figured out that the first transmitter and the first antenna and the first console and miscellaneous tape recorders and turntables had some value that, you know, Lorenzo had bought them all as junk somewhere and that KBOO should pay him. And I think it was like $500 or $5,000 or something. And KBOO came up with the money and we bought our equipment.
Bought themselves out of chattel slavery.
And then the commission duly approved the license transfer, and the KABU Foundation was born. But that was like 70.
I remember being so disappointed and seeing it as a sign of the times ahead when nobody would even consider naming it anything but the KABU Foundation. It had come out of this long history of bizarrely named organizations. Its parent was the Jack Straw Memorial Foundation, which named after Jack Straw, who participated in Wat Tyler's rebellion in England in the 14th century or something.
It's Chaucerian.
It's Chaucerian, yeah. It appears in one of Chaucer's tales. Lorenzo was
the Nun's Priest Tale.
Yeah, the Nun's Priest Tale. Lorenzo was a Chaucerian scholar. That's what he studied in college and done his thesis on. The quote from Chaucer was, I may not get this right, but it was, "Nay, Jack Straw and his merry men could make a noise, hey, so shrill." And that was Lorenzo's inspiration for calling his radio station the Jack Straw Memorial Foundation, because it was to be a shrill voice in the airwaves amongst the Mantovani and 1001 Strings.
We didn't have that brilliant, bizarre, and completely arbitrary and difficult person to run things at that time. That was when KABU had its own organization, and it was different than having Lorenzo, who had his very good parts, but he was also the boss. And, you know, it was a single-man organization. And the initial KABU was run that way by Calhoun. I mean, there was no one else here. And then KABU just became, you know, the popular voice, the voice of consensus, the voice of the committee. And that, I guess, was inevitable. But it was sad to note the passing of and not the literary, you know, crapola where people are putting on airs. But, you know, the original KABU was early music and was very literate.
It was a station clearly inspired and run by people who believed in things of the mind, that thought that were intellectual.
The pretense of the middle class to emulate that and to put on airs and be phony is nothing like that.
Right, yeah.
This was the real thing.
Yeah.
And that's what I, this total misfit, oddball, nerd guy, stumbled into. And for some reason, these people embraced me with open arms, and I never knew why. It took me decades to figure out that I was one of them. And they were, it's like, why did these guys want me around? It was interesting. And I guess it's, you know, we should be politically correct now and say there just weren't any women then. I don't think it was misogynist, but there weren't.
Just weren't. There were a few. I mean, Karen Burdick was in very early in the process.
And was program director.
I hauled her down to the station. I met her my freshman year. She was a freshman the same year I was at Reed. And I think I hauled her to the station within the first year I was there. So she was involved. And Liz Daly.
Right.
She was involved.
When did the women first, because it sounds like it was real male until a certain time when there must have.
That's primarily because there was very few people. I mean, there was, like I say, Karen was down there by, February of 69 mm-hmm. at any rate, real early in the process. I'd met her at Reed, and she was doing a show at Reed, and I really liked what she did, and I suggested she come down to KABU, and she got involved. And there was Liz Daly. I mean, there were a fair number of women involved at Crab.
But once KABU got out of the basement and moved to Belmont Street, it was totally different.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It became real different.
It was very egalitarian.
Yeah. And it largely because it had become large at that point. I mean, you know, it's hard to maintain proportions when you've got five people. Mm-hmm. Everybody becomes a very significant percentage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, when the station became much larger, a lot more women came in. And more black people. I mean, George was involved real early, the late George Page.
Mm-hmm.
He was public affairs director over on Belmont Street. I mean, I suppose we ought to do a brief chronology of locations here for people.
That's true.
I mean, KABU started out with no studio at all. It was strictly an off-the-air repeater, signed on in July of 68. And the main studio of record was the basement of one of Calhoun's friends' house, who was housebound with MS. And he had the switch. There was a box with a switch in it. It's connected to a phone line, which turned the transmitter on and off. And that was his job. He turned the transmitter on and off.
When?
Whenever there was programming. Whenever Crab was on the air, he would turn it on. And when Crab was signed off, he'd turn it off. And by September or October of that year, we got the little studio on 3rd and Salmon, the 8x12 office. And by December of that year, we were actually able to broadcast from there. We built the Turkey Mark, whatever it was, the first console, which was a, in fact, it's still around here someplace. It's an old set of Presto record electronics that got modified.
Why do you call it Turkey Mark?
That was a Benjaminism.
Yeah.
Benjamin Franklin Dawson III, the engineering grandfather of all the community radio stations, along with Jeremy Lanzmann, slapped together a recording amplifier, a tube-type recording amplifier for an old Presto tape recorder, and by modifying it a little bit, made it suitable for a broadcast booth control board, and sent it down as, I remember his words, temporary emergency in-term equipment. And it was on the air and for daily use for the next 10 years.
Something like that, right? It worked, sort of. Almost as well as the current Turkey Mark 22.
And Benjamin was one of those persons like Gray, who was a religion major at Reed.
Benjamin was a literature graduate of Harvard.
And, you know, he was a word guy that was good with technical things. I guess we all were. And he just liked the word turkey, so he named it the Turkey Mark X.
That was a real turkey of a thing, you know. And everything's been named Turkey Mark something or other ever since. At any rate, we were in the little 8x12 office down there that Don Chambers, very liberal to progressive attorney in Portland who died about 5 years ago now, he owned the building there on the corner of 3rd and Salmon, and there was this little office that he would let progressive organizations have for 6 months or a year or something. Before us, I think it was the Peace and Freedom Party had the office. It had no windows. That was our first control room. We used to sit out on the front steps a lot. I mean, at any rate, after about 6 months or a year, Don passed that office on to somebody else, but essentially gave us the basement, which was a huge basement. It had originally been set up, I think there was an Elks Club or something in this building. It had been set up. It had a kitchen down there and all sorts of things that were left over from being able to cater things. But
and the cockroaches.
And the cockroaches, lots of cockroaches. And we literally curtained off a portion. We had old rugs and things hanging from wires to define rooms. There were no walls down there. Mm. We were there for, when did we move out of there finally?
Summer of 70.
God, was it that soon? It seemed like it was there forever, but... Again, no windows. Yeah, we moved uptown to the big quarters on Belmont then, 30th and Belmont, where...
Do you know how that got picked as a location?
It was available.
One of KBOO's early, Wayne Waits, early volunteers, got in the car with Roger Ferguson, who had taken over from Calhoun as station manager, and they got in Ferguson's car and they drove out to 82nd on Hawthorne, because that's the connecting street for the old KBOO building on 3rd and Salmon. And didn't find any storefronts for rent and went up 82nd to Belmont and came back down Belmont and saw this thing for rent and rented it.
We moved in there. We built, managed to get two walls up. And boy, that was hard getting those two walls up.
And a lot of the work was done by the grandson of Frederick Law Olmsted, the man who laid out Central Park.
And many of the parks in Portland, too. He was an early consultant for the Parks Department here. And at that point, about a year into that, when John Ross had become our manager, we got the first grant from the federal government to buy equipment. Then the Department of HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, had programs under a different department now. So we got, all of a sudden, we went from the Turkey Mark whatever to all of this brand new equipment walking through the door. I mean, gleaming and shiny.
There was,
and no place to put it.
There was nowhere to put it. We had boxes and boxes and boxes of fancy. I mean, this was a $70,000 grant in the early 70s. We had a moving van full of brand new broadcast equipment. We didn't even have a place to put it all, let alone take it out of the boxes and use it.
Right. I mean, you couldn't even stack the boxes up.
So what happened to it?
It was put in David Roland's garage and other places and just left there for years. Never installed, never inventoried. No one ever knew what was going on. And finally, they were threatened to take it away from us if we didn't use it. And so we had to inventory it and put it in service or we're going to lose this equipment. And I ended up getting the job of inventorying it and figuring it out. And I figured this whole grant out, found all these things, got all the documentation, and ended up going to Washington, D.C. on another adventure and talking to Mary Denota, the lady who was in charge of those grants, and she said, I was on vacation when this grant was submitted. You would have never received this. But John Ross knew who to send it to, who didn't know what was going on when I was gone. And that's how you people got this stuff. And that's how KABU moved from Belmont to downtown, because we had to get a big enough space to open the boxes and put the equipment to use. We had to go 24 hours, because there was no way to let people in and out of the building, because it was the second floor.
Never finished building Yamhill either.
Before we were kicked out of there. That was interesting. The engineers told KABU, don't do it. Don't move to the second story of a building downtown. But the board had been slow in their responsibilities to find a place, and at the last minute had to move. And so a board member who was full of hatred, ex-hippie dope smoker turned anti-hippie hater, maneuvered KABU into a building that it should never have been in. The landlord didn't like KABU. And as soon as the $80,000 investment was made and we were in there and bankrupt, he wouldn't renew the lease. And in like 2 days, two men with electric saws cut it out, threw it out the window and into a drop box after we moved. Yep. We just lost all that investment and all that effort.
Cut everything you'd built in there, you're saying?
Yeah. They stripped the space and threw it away.
There's nothing more useless than a radio station if you don't want to run a radio station in a space.
And then I think it was Damon Tempe, bless his heart, found this building and we bought it.
Yeah.
Again, under fire.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the last minute when it was, you know, almost too late, found this thing.
Do you want to talk about some of these early personalities that you mentioned? Schwartz?
Al Schwartz. Well, everyone's lost track of him.
Yeah.
He went off and became an AP stringer in New York.
Yeah, he was an AP stringer here in town. He worked for AP. Worked for a commercial station.
Yeah, he was professional. I mean, he wasn't like the rest of us. He had clean clothes that fit, that didn't come out of dump boxes. And he was a broadcaster. He was a journalist. And he showed up in the early days, and he was consistent and reliable and produced a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
He did a lot of tape, you know, record things, and he did a higher level of production than other people. He would actually make a program. I remember him for his consistency and amidst sort of the amorphous, you never knew who was going to be there and, you know, what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Schwartz was real stable. KABU was home to organists and early music people initially.
Right. One of the things they figured out, because it's the logical thing, is if you want to do music, you don't hire radio people. Because what do they know about music? You hire musicians, you know, because they know about music. And all these musicians who were actively involved in lots of stuff that were dirt poor got jobs or were volunteers here because it was the only place that they could hear the music they liked, and it's the only place they could get jobs sometimes was associated with music.
And it was our experience of radio people then was zero. There weren't any.
Well, we were very anti-radio. I mean, that KABU was not community radio. That was a term that happened much later. It was alternative radio, and it was designed to be something different than what radio was out there. And part of that was a disavowal of those sort of professional radio, you know, the ways of...
But what I referred to always as hermetically sealed radio.
Yeah.
You know, the buses went down Belmont Street and rattled the turntables. On Yamhill, because it was such a very narrow space and it was all windows on one side, from the control room mic to the open window onto the street was like 10 feet, maybe 12. And with the control room door open, which didn't have a seal on it anyway, and the windows open in the hallway, KABU was connected to the world. It wasn't locked away, which is a sad thing about where we are now, is we're down inside the bowels of this little concrete building and there are no sight lines to the street, there's no street noise, and I miss that. And I don't think radio has to be professionals and doesn't have to be isolated.
Right. And you know, we actively did not encourage people to have radio personality at all. In fact, it was generally considered kind of déclassé to use your name on the radio. And certainly professional announcing style was a no-no.
David Roland used to read all the letters that we got. That was one thing he did. And periodically he'd point out interesting things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we used to have a lot of reading on the radio. That was one of the hallmarks that came out of Crab, readings from the New Yorker, the Manchester Guardian, and various things, essays, political commentary, that sort of thing, to try to bring points of view into the community that it might not otherwise see. That was a time, the FCC inspection. Remember that one?
we almost got in trouble.
Right. This was when we were on Belmont Street. And in those days, the engineer was required to inspect the transmitter 5 days out of every seven. He had to go to the transmitter, look at it, make an entry in the log. And I was working at the medical school.
Down the hill from the transmitter.
Down the hill from the transmitter, but I didn't have any transportation. I wasn't driving. I was taking the bus and things like that. And I hadn't gotten up the hill to the transmitter in a couple of weeks. And I get this call from KABU saying, "Why don't you come over to the studio, Gray? The FCC is here to pay us a visit and an inspection." And I go, "Oh, God." And I call Robert up and I say, "Robert, go up the hill right now and forge my name for the last 2 weeks before we get up there, because I'll keep him busy at the studio for a while." So I kept him busy at the studio. And they're busy asking, "Now, you've done your transmitter inspections, haven't you?" "Oh, certainly. Of course, sir. I always do my transmitter inspections." And we get done at the studio. And we go up the hill. Robert is left by this point. And I open up the log to show him the thing. And here it is in blue pencil after my last entry, FCC, bump, 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 bump. They'd been in the building inspecting somebody else and had opened the log and marked this thing in. So when Robert gets it, there's like no place to put the forge because it's pretty obvious at that point.
But the problem with that was there was very little light in that building. It was an unfinished garage. And for light, we had a 600-watt antenna beacon, the light bulb that blinks on and off on top of the towers at night. We'd found a case of them in that garage because Harold Singleton was an old radio engineer. And we had soldered leads onto it, no socket, and draped it over a nail in the ceiling so you could work on the transmitter. But that didn't illuminate the area where the log was kept very well. And I had snagged the program director, who was Bill Reinhardt, who had good handwriting, to copy Gray's signature. And he was busy copying Gray's signature and was about to put pen on paper and write Gray Hartig and phony up the date. And I noticed in light printing above it, the FCC guy's name. I said, "Stop! Don't do that! Don't touch it!"